Well, at least we know the loser in the Iowa caucuses last night. More on the Texas implications of the false start to election season 2020 today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. As the Trump administration clamps down on asylum seekers, immigration attorneys are forging new legal pathways. We'll hear about one of them. Also, one of the greatest authors of the Americas reconsidered in a bilingual exhibit launched in the Texas capital city. Plus, changing attitudes among Texans when it comes to gun control. More in favor? More on that story and then some when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this fourth day of February 2020. I'm David Brown. The sign outside one caucus site read, "The road to 2020 starts here." If by here they mean Iowa, then the Democrats desperately need to think about unplugging that GPS and finding some good old-fashioned road maps, because this road trip ain't off to a solid start. Actually, it's far worse than that. Consider, after years of waiting for this moment, an opportunity to topple a president that the vast majority of Democrats find more than merely objectionable, after marches on Washington, after four, five, six, how many debates, yesterday was, from the perspective of Democrats, supposed to mark the beginning of the end of the Trump administration. And yet that day came to a close with a mighty... Is something wrong here? Once Republicans are done having a laugh, even they would have to agree what happened in Iowa is a massive metaphor for American politics right now. For Iowa, whose position as the first caucus state had been brought into question, the stakes could not have been higher. Iowa's not about delegates, after all. It's about the bump. But there won't be an Iowa bump. Instead, the winner, whoever that turns out to be, will have a victory sullied by questions about process and lingering suspicions from challengers over what happened. Are those suspicions fair? Why not? Why leave the vote open to an untested app, one that cybersecurity experts have been warning about in the run-up to this moment? Even if one were to overlook the fact that the preamble to this event, the influential Des Moines Register poll, had to be scrapped because of technical glitches, the only thing that would make this whole affair more suspicious might be if the app that wrecked the caucuses had been designed by a company owned by Michael Bloomberg. Now, there's no indication that it was, of course, that's ridiculous, but the fact that there's still no rational explanation for what happened in Iowa, after all these hours, has to shake anyone's faith in repeated reassurances about the security of our elections processes. Oh, and one other thing. The president, who, parenthetically speaking, appears likely to be acquitted on impeachment charges tomorrow, is set to deliver the State of the Union tonight. How does one even begin to understand what's happened? Well, we are going to begin with Texas and what the Iowa fiasco means for us. Someone who's been watching the results from El Paso is Richard Pineda. He is chair of the Communications Department at the University of Texas at El Paso. Professor Pineda, welcome back to the Standard.
Great to be here, David.
I can't think of any time in the past when a Democratic primary has handed a victory to a Republican, but some would argue that's sort of what's happened here. Is there another way to view this?
I think that that's probably spot on. I mean, I think going into Tuesday, the Democrats are really flailing. I thought last night what was interesting was you really got to see the character and the strategy of the campaign. So Klobuchar starts off with a very measured message. We punched above our weight. Warren sort of responds with, "We're feeling really good." By the time we got to Mayor Pete at about midnight, it was, "I won. Iowa sent a message to the country." The fact that you've got that many winners trying to scrape for the pie, I think, is problematic. But the truth of the matter is that this is a huge rhetorical moment for the president to have the Democrats look like they're uncertain of who a possible frontrunner is. He has the opportunity tonight to deliver a State of the Union, and most assuredly, come Wednesday, he'll be acquitted of the impeachment charges. And so for the Democrats to not have a frontrunner and to be able to change the narrative between now and New Hampshire is very problematic.
It was probably predictable that President Trump would delight in sending out tweets last night as there was meltdown in Iowa. Perhaps less predictable was a tweet from Texan Julian Castro, who called the Iowa caucuses a total mess. Not that anyone would necessarily disagree with him, but he was pretty outspoken about what's happened here. And he's been pushing this narrative to make other states the first in the nation in this primary process. How much do you think what happened last night helps his case?
Oh, I think tremendously. I think that there is a good chance that the biggest loser at this point in the primary is going to be the state of Iowa. The Iowa Democratic Party really has egg on its face. And, you know, the challenges that Castro has been talking about and others, David, are really tied to the fact that Iowa's demographics do not match the rest of the country. While this is a process that is very much open and is situated in the most public displays of politics, to a certain extent, the fact that it is so archaic and made worse by the attempts to modernize, I think may in fact put the nail in the coffin for Iowa to be the first primary. I mean, I think that the Democratic Party at the national level is really going to have to insert themselves and change up what happens in the next presidential election.
Texas has Super Tuesday coming up, of course, on March 3rd. Do you think that what happened in Iowa changes the calculus at all? I mean, you mentioned how Amy Klobuchar was smart enough to get out in front right there with her message, declaring a victory, and then heading up to New Hampshire. Does that do anything to the sort of the larger sense of winners and losers at the end of the day?
You know, I think that the issue going into today to New Hampshire is going to be fundraising. And I think that that's the reason the Iowa bump has such significance for candidates, because it's a way to turn back to the rest of your to the rest of your supporters around the country and say, listen, I'm viable. This is a win. And if you're in the top three, that should give you enough strength to get into New Hampshire. And then if you can double up and get another win in New Hampshire, then you really are starting to build momentum. No Democrat is going to have that momentum, even when the results come through potentially today. That momentum is going to be lost because the news cycle will be all about the president. So I think by the time we get to Super Tuesday, there will be a better sense of where things are going. But I just think that this creates such a fiasco going into New Hampshire. And I think what it's going to do is create a lot of internal division in the party. So I think these candidates are going to start to really talk about each other in a way that up until the caucuses, they seem to be fairly friendly and tended to stay a little bit away from throwing punches. I think just in assessing who's claiming victory and who has the data to make that claim, I think you're going to see a couple of elbows thrown this morning as these candidates descend into New Hampshire.
Richard Pineda is chair of the Communications Department at the University of Texas at El Paso. Professor, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
You're very welcome.
For Central and South Americans fleeing violence or persecution, getting asylum protection in the U.S. has never been an easy matter. Since 2017, the Trump administration has taken several steps to make the process more difficult, with new definitions for eligibility and restrictions on entry before a hearing. Now immigration attorneys are turning to other legal alternatives. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall reports on one such strategy.
Locked up in an immigration detention center outside Houston, 24-year-old Dania tells the story of why she left her home country, Honduras. Over the phone, she says gang members tried to convince her to be a prostitute. Dania refused and went to the police. But afterward, she tells me police officers came to her house and raped her for not complying with the gang. That's when Dania headed north to the United States. She explains how difficult it was to leave everything behind. Dania says she swam the Rio Grande hoping to get help in the U.S. Before last summer, Dania would have had a case for asylum here. But the Trump administration has narrowed who qualifies. Dania was deemed ineligible for asylum because she failed to apply in another country on the way here. Her pro bono attorney, Fariha Chaudhry, says all Dania wants is to live freely. Chaudhry asked that we not use Dania's last name for her protection.
We just want the judge to understand that, you know, this woman has been terrorized. She's been raped, which is a protected ground and considered past persecution.
Since asylum wasn't an option, they turned to the Convention Against Torture. That's a United Nations human rights treaty that the U.S. joined in the 90s. Under the treaty, nearly 170 nations have agreed to protect people fleeing torture around the world. In the past, immigration lawyers say asylum was their first and best choice. It provided immigrants a shot at citizenship, more protections, and an easier path than other legal avenues.
Those were the backups.
That's Houston immigration attorney Ruby Powers.
But now we're seeing people are barred from asylum because of or whatever reasons. And so withholding of removal and Convention Against Torture are becoming more of a focus and not just an afterthought.
But protections under things like withholding of removal and Convention Against Torture are hard to get. In fiscal year 2018, 1,300 people were allowed to stay in the U.S. under Convention Against Torture. Nearly 26,000 people were denied. And in December, the Department of Justice made it even more difficult. Now it's harder to prove that police tortured in their official capacity. Being in uniform, for instance, isn't enough. Dree Colopy is a D.C.-based immigration attorney.
Decisions like this that basically give judges who are less inclined to provide due process and less inclined to interpret the law favorably for a respondent, it gives them the tools to easily just grasp on that and say no.
That's what Danya's father, Melvin, fears could happen in her case. Ultimately, it's up to a judge to decide her fate. Melvin, a construction worker in Houston, says it would be painful if the judge denies his daughter's opportunity to stay here. He says she'll spend her life on the run if she returns home.
Sería muy doloroso que en verdad.
He hasn't seen Danya in 14 years when he left Honduras because of the rampant crime. He says he's raised her from afar, sending money and calling her 3 times a week. He always waited for the day they'd be together. Now that she's so close, he's worried it will never happen. I'm Elizabeth Trobal in Houston.
Joining us once again in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. The seemingly botched rollout of results from the Iowa caucuses sparking a lot of talk on social
seemingly.
Media. Yes, including our Facebook page there. Timothy Gaskell says, I'm a software developer and follow tech news. Sadly, seeing someone bank on untested technology working well and then having a bumpy rollout is not that surprising. Brent Crockett quips, need to demonstrate why we need electoral reforms? There's an app for that. Christopher Chomboski says, so far, the winner of the Iowa caucuses is Joe Biden, since we can't see that he was beaten, referring there to recent polling going into the caucus. The loser is whoever runs the Iowa Democratic Party. And Garrett Bailey says, so glad Texas did away with the caucus. 2008 was a disaster. I remember that. Been a little rough night there for then-candidates Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, boy. So, although I don't think this one has any parallel,
nope.
I'll be honest with you. We'd love to hear what you think, Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard or find your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for your comments, and he'll be back with more of them in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Business and your money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. You've likely seen them on Texas highways, beat up pickup trucks loaded with everything from used washing machines to household items to bikes, the words in tow taped across the tailgate. Behind the wheel are transmigrantes, drivers from Central America hoping to give these unwanted goods a second life back home. For years, the Mexican government's funneled these drivers through a small border town in the Rio Grande Valley, but now, as Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales tells us, there's speculation Mexico's moving some of that traffic west to Presidio.
It's 9 a.m. at a gas station in Marfa, and Guatemalan Vener Lopez is looking over the goods in the back of the 80s-era Toyota he's towing.
Well, here in the back of my truck, I have things that we're going to sell over there in Guatemala.
He's got a ladder, an old bathroom scale, even a motorbike, and everything's secondhand. It's chilly this early in the morning, and the soft-spoken Lopez sports a track jacket in several days' stubble. For the last 4 years, he's traveled from his home in Guatemala to buy secondhand goods at auctions in the U.S., picking up crumbling vehicles and appliances for cheap. Transmigrantes like Lopez then drive thousands of miles back to their own country, hoping to resell for a slight profit.
Gracias a Dios que tenemos la oportunidad de...
Thank God we have the opportunity to travel and live like this for a better future for our family.
From this stop in Marfa, Lopez and the other drivers he's caravanning with have more than 600 miles before they get to Los Indios in South Texas. Right now, that's the only border crossing where transmigrantes are allowed into Mexico. So, it's busy.
You're looking at between 8 to 10, maybe even 12,000 vehicles a month that will cross over.
Jose Portillo is Presidio's city manager. He's seen briefings to Mexico's president arguing this new route through his city into Ojinaga across the border.
We have nothing official and in writing that says this is going to happen. Do we suspect? Yeah. And if I were a betting man, I'd probably bet it is going to happen.
And the decision is entirely up to the Mexican government. Portillo and other Presidio officials are trying to figure out how transmigrante traffic could impact the city's resources and infrastructure and its only major highway, US 67.
Transmigrantes have a reputation of driving very, very conservatively. So when you put in the mix our drivers who like to really test that 70-mile-an-hour speed limit, it's a recipe for disaster.
It's not just the extra vehicles on the road. Wait times on the international bridge here can be long. Two more lanes are being added, but locals think that still won't be enough to handle current traffic. And transmigrantes need to wait in the U.S. up to 72 hours while their paperwork's processed at the port of entry. There's also worries about increased crime in Presidio and especially Ojinaga. Vener Lopez, the Guatemalan driver we met earlier, says that's because once in Mexico, transmigrantes are often targeted and face extortion.
A veces corremos riesgos, pero...
Sometimes we take risks, but no risk, no reward.
That sentiment shared by some in the business community who think this change could mean big bucks. Like Jose Antonio Mercado, a broker who makes a living filling out the forms needed for shipments passing through Mexico.
From the moment they arrive to Presidio, people that have driven 15, 20 hours are going to need to eat. They're going to have to shower. They're going to need to sleep. And you multiply that by 100, 200 people a day who are going to cross?
Right now, Los Indios, where transmigrantes currently cross, is a town roughly a fifth the size of Presidio. And there are several businesses there that directly cater to drivers.
So there's going to be a wide range of opportunities for not only the brokers, but other people.
That's Isela Nunez, a former Presidio City Council member. She's been running a brokerage company for the last 9 years and says talk of transmigrantes in Presidio has been going on for years. And now that it seems more and more likely, she has some mixed feelings about it.
Presidio is going to have to really pay attention as to what are we going to do? How are we going to be prepared?
If you don't prepare, you've prepared to fail.
City manager Jose Portillo doesn't want that to happen. Some first steps, a city ordinance passed in early January designates where transmigrantes can park in town. And the city's proposed building a municipal parking lot where drivers would wait for their turn to cross into Mexico. While everything remains up in the air, some brokers I've talked to in Mexico believe a formal announcement designating the Presidio port of entry for transmigrante traffic could happen sometime in February. I'm Carlos Morales in Presidio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. President Trump is set to give his third State of the Union address tonight. This year, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer is slated to deliver the Democratic response in English, and Veronica Escobar, the freshman congresswoman from El Paso, will deliver it in Spanish. As Mallory Falk of our partner station KERA reports, it's a return to the spotlight of sorts for Escobar and her city.
Almost immediately after she took office, Veronica Escobar started leading congressional delegations to the border. Last January, she stood with several lawmakers near a newly built section of border wall, tall steel slats that cut through the desert. For people who live on the border, she said,
"It's frustrating to know that we are being painted as a dangerous place meant to be controlled, when what we see is a place of complexity and beauty."
Escobar was elected to fill the seat previously held by Beto O'Rourke, one of the first two Latinas to represent Texas in Congress. But what's truly put her in the spotlight is criticism of the Trump administration's immigration policies at a time when the border and El Paso have dominated the news. Here she is speaking at a House hearing about family separation and migrant detention.
My district is ground zero for these atrocities. These policies have created the humanitarian crisis and a moral one.
Last August, a white gunman from North Texas who said he was targeting Mexicans killed 22 people at an El Paso Walmart. When President Trump announced plans to visit days after the shooting, Escobar told MSNBC he wasn't welcome.
The president has made my community and my people the enemy. He has told the country that we are people to be feared, people to be hated.
Those who've known Escobar throughout her career say they're not surprised about her outspokenness.
She has a way of speaking that is not insulting, and yet you know where she stands. She's not wishy-washy in the least.
That's Raymond Caballero, a former mayor of El Paso. Escobar volunteered for his campaign back in 2001 and made such a strong impression he hired her as his communications director. She eventually became county commissioner, then county judge, top positions in the place where her family's run a dairy farm for several generations. Escobar hasn't joined some fellow Democrats who want to abolish ICE. Instead, she's pushing for increased oversight and accountability.
Well, I think she takes a realistic and pragmatic view.
Elliot Shapley is a former state senator from El Paso who's long worked with Escobar.
There is going to be a Homeland Security agency that relates to border enforcement issues, so she knows that. So what does she do? She says, let's reform ICE.
Tonight, she'll reach an even larger audience when she helps deliver the Democratic Party's response to Trump in Spanish. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin-watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The state agency responsible for investigating the abuse, neglect, and exploitation of adults, including those 65 and older, is seeing a drop in caseworker turnover. During fiscal year 2019, the rate dropped nearly 5 points to about 20%. That's similar to the rate of employee turnover across state government in Texas. Kez Wold is the Associate Commissioner for Adult Protective Services. He says raises the state legislature approved last year are helping the agency hold on to employees.
By retaining staff, particularly those first-year caseworkers, if we are able to retain them and they can learn the job and become confident in what they're doing and competent at what they're doing, we are going to be providing better services to clients. And that's the really exciting news.
APS caseworkers and frontline supervisors received an annual raise of $9,000. Parts of the Texas Panhandle are forecast to receive at least a light dusting of snow today, but in recent years, the area has been seeing less of the wintry precipitation. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
The average snowfall in Amarillo is supposed to be 17.9 inches a year, but it's failed to reach that level for the past 4 years. National Weather Service meteorologist Douglas Weber says so far this year, Amarillo has only had 5.5 inches. Which is well below normal and could lead to wildfires.
If we don't get the moisture, either in rain or snow of some form, then the fuels can dry out. And because the Panhandles is one of the windiest places in the country, and we can have very low relative humidities on the lee side of the Rockies. Those combined can make for some bad grass fires.
He says the wildfire threat could especially be bad for cattle ranchers in Amarillo, one of the largest meatpacking areas in the country.
Sasha Cordner reporting. Classes are canceled through Wednesday at Texas A&M University Commerce following yesterday's shooting at a residence hall that left two women dead. A toddler, who was also wounded, is in stable condition at a local hospital. Monday's incident comes just months after a shooting at an off-campus party in nearby Greenville last November. Jack Simonek is a student at Texas A&M Commerce. He says he and his classmates took the school's shelter-in-place email seriously.
Because of the Greenville incident, that's still in our minds. People are still grieving for that. And so when that first email came out, that was probably their first thought.
Multiple law enforcement agencies are investigating the shooting.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University, focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
Got to tune to the Texas Standard. Imagine finding out at the start of the school year that your children would be losing their school at the end of the year. Well, that's what happened to around 300 parents from the west side of San Antonio a year and a half ago. Rodriguez Elementary School had been falling short of state academic standards for years. After failing a fifth year in a row, Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath says he was forced to take action, leaving many parents unsure of their children's academic future. Well, now the state is reopening the campus. Sort of. Texas is letting the district convert its neighborhood elementary into a Montessori dual language school. Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips reports on how families in the area are taking the news.
To understand what happened, let's go back to meet the teacher night at Rodriguez Elementary during the 2018-2019 school year. Marissa Alvarado's daughter, Allison, was in second grade. She received a letter in the mail about the closure the same day as that parent-teacher night.
It was just a big shocker. Everybody was confused.
She knew Rodriguez faced sanctions if it failed the state's academic standards a fifth time. But the district had poured resources into the school, and it was improving.
We thought everything was going to be okay, that we were going to make it out of IR, and we didn't.
The school's academic accountability score had just come out. Rodriguez scored a 56, but needed a 60 to be in the clear. State law gave Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath two options: close the school or replace San Antonio ISD's elected school board. He chose to close the school. Allison's mom says it was difficult for the students to go to Rodriguez Elementary every day, knowing it was their last year.
Word started going around that the school was closing because the kids weren't smart enough. Children were thinking that it was their fault.
Alvarado says she's grateful to Allison's teacher for helping her convince her daughter that she wasn't responsible. San Antonio ISD leaders say they wouldn't have closed the school if it had been up to them.
You know, when you close the school, you close the community. It is true.
Mohammed Chowdhury is the district's chief innovation officer.
Like, closure is the hardest thing there is in any school district.
To lessen the blow, the district started immediately looking into ways to reopen the school. State law allows districts to reopen low-performing schools if they have a different academic model, and the commissioner approves.
You know, at first it was important for us to see what kind of new Rodriguez folks wanted, right?
Chowdhury says his office held three community meetings and collected 100 survey responses. They eventually decided to turn Rodriguez into a Montessori school with a dual-language pathway. SAISD's existing Montessori school has one of the longest wait lists in the district, and the new school seems to be generating interest. Around a dozen families attended an information night at Rodriguez early last month.
And they show you how they use it. They show you what they've been learning.
Staff members from the district's other Montessori school tell the parents about the model.
That's where you get to ask your child a lot of questions like, well, what is this for? And what are you learning?
Associate Principal Rebecca Gonzalez says the school emphasizes independence and lets students learn at their own pace. She finishes with an invitation to step into a smaller room in the back.
We have iPads, we have laptops if you would like to apply.
I meet Valerie Morales while parents talk one-on-one with the staff. Her three-year-old daughter, Ella Mae, flits between the Chips Ahoy on the table and the movie in the childcare room.
Please.
Right. Morales says she wants to get Ella Mae into school early.
There's, I think, only a few that have the pre-K-3. So it kind of narrows it down.
One of her teacher friends suggested Morales look into Montessori.
The structure and the ideas behind it, the philosophy is different. So we're hoping she won't be stifled and hopefully encourages her natural curiosity and stuff. So.
The district plans to give families who live in the neighborhood first priority for the new school. Former Rodriguez Elementary mom Marissa Alvarado likes the education model, but...
We kind of feel robbed because why didn't they bring something like this before Rodriguez closed?
Most kids who used to walk to the school won't be able to return. The district plans to build the school back up to fifth grade over several years, but first is the highest they'll have available next year. Alvarado says her daughter Allison is doing well in third grade at her new elementary a mile away. She tells me even if her daughter were young enough for the new Rodriguez, she wouldn't want to put her through another change in schools. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
Texas A&M University has settled a 2018 lawsuit brought by the animal rights group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, a.k.a. PETA. Activists have long gone after the university for its animal research. The AP reports PETA sued Texas A&M over what it claimed were First Amendment violations when the university hid comments on its Facebook page with words dog, abuse, and testing. The school contends it did no wrong, but under the settlement, it'll pay $75,000 in legal fees to PETA and agrees, quote, not to exercise in viewpoint discrimination. Texas A&M says it will still regulate Facebook comments for relevance. 39 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at RandGroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It'll be 7 years this year since Texas became home to the Gabriel Garcia Marquez Archives and Collection. Works and artifacts of the Columbia Nobel Prize winner for literature now live at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. But the public's had virtually no access to that collection until now. Alvaro Santana Acuna curated the bilingual exhibit Gabriel Garcia Marquez, The Making of a Global Writer, that opened this past weekend. He's also the author of a forthcoming book, Ascent to Glory, The Transformation of 100 Years of Solitude into a Global Classic. Dr. Santana Acuna, welcome to the Texas Standard. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, too. Thank you.
What is it about this book? You can't talk about Gabriel Garcia Marquez without talking about the book itself. What made it into the global phenomenon that it is, do you think?
Yeah, that's right. The main answer is that classics are meaningful works of art that speak to people from all countries, cultures, over generations. And this is precisely what's also happening to 100 Years of Solitude, to the point that even now, last month, distant star, which is 91 light years away from the Earth, mm-hmm. has name after Macondo, which is the village at the center of the novel.
Wow, right? Yeah. Something that's a little hard to overstate is how much this novel is a part of arts and letters in Latin America, most certainly. But the fact is that this is a book that has sold more worldwide than Homer's Odyssey, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sold more than some of the greatest works of mm-hmm. of what that people think of as part of the Western civilization canon, right?
Absolutely. Even though it's a book written in Latin America, has right. entered the Western canon. And you're right. You know, the exhibition has mainly two parts, and 100 Years of Solitude is really at the center of the exhibition because it really cut Garcia Marquez's life into two parts. So the first part of the exhibition is really telling a story about how the world made Garcia mm-hmm, Marquez. Mm-hmm. And then the second half, you can start seeing the world that Garcia Marquez created. And then you can see how his work has not only influenced politics and culture, but also, as we saw in the Super Bowl, Shakira was performing during the halftime show. So they were close friends. Garcia Marquez was someone who even wrote a statement, which is shown there in the exhibition, in which he said that she was going to become one of the greatest artists of these times.
He didn't, I think,
understand or realize that the book would be anything like as popular as it became. Let's hear what he had to say on that subject.
No sé a qué hora sucedió todo.
I don't know when this happened, is what he's saying there.
Nunca he visto nada distinto que mis dos dedos índices golpeando una.
The only thing I've seen since I started writing is my two index fingers hitting the 28 letters of the alphabet on my keyboard in a steady rhythm. It seemed, correct me if I'm wrong, he wrote it in 67, but it's not an instant hit.
I think what happened is that the book gathered sustained attention over time. So even though it was not this instant bestseller compared to other contemporary books, it certainly became a book that survived the 6 to 12 months that it was supposed to be on the market.
This is a book that is not without a certain degree of controversy, even though it is accepted as an important work. Not everyone loves or has loved reading it. Why is it so polarizing, do you think?
That's right. That's actually one of the things that I write about in my book, is that we tend to think about classics as works that only attract positive reactions, but the truth is that classics are works that attract as much positive as well as negative reactions. So we may think about, for instance, Shakespeare and Tolstoy, and the famous Russian writer, he truly hated Shakespeare's works, right? And in the case of One Day of Solitude, it's also a book that over generations has continued to attract time and energy from people who use that energy and time to really express their negative opinions about the book. And that's what I call entrenched criticism, as something that also really helps to make books classics.
But there is something about the book, I suppose we should talk about the magic realism, I think, is mm-hmm. something that's often discussed. And that is, sometimes it's difficult for the reader to know what sort of area one is navigating in. Do you have a sense that made it extremely hard for this to become an international book? Because how do you translate some of these mm-hmm. notions? I mean, even the title itself has mm-hmm. a certain ambiguity to it.
Mm-hmm. What I can tell you is that even from the beginning, readers struggled to understand what the style of the book was about. So we now think about this book as kind of the quintessential or the Bible of magical realism. But even the term magical realism was not really applied to the novel a couple of years after it came out. So at the beginning, critics, readers were really puzzled about this hybrid mixture of the fantasy and the real. And then over time, it was labeled as magical realism. And as you said, it's a style that Hollywood filmmakers such as Guillermo del Toro have followed in their works. And I think that García Márquez tapped into something that is really central to our lives, right? The idea that there is a dimension to life that is not just materialistic and realistic, but also fantasy and imagination. And I think that's one of the reasons also why this book eventually became so successful, because it was really able to find that imaginary dimension in our lives that sometimes goes unnoticed.
How do you communicate the impact or even the significance of the style to a generation that's used to 180 characters in a tweet or something like that? How well do you think this book translates today?
Well, I must say that this book continues to be sold in multiple countries and being read by new generations, either because they have to read it in high school uh-huh. or in college. And I remember once coming across one of my students who would actually tell me that he had like three copies of the book in his dorm.
Is that right?
So there is a sense in which this book is finding its way into the lives of new generations of readers across the world. And this is something that even for me, it's mysterious, you know. And of course, we can also talk about the Netflix adaptation, which is coming up, you know, sometime soon, maybe this year, next year, which is certainly going to then create a new generation of readers for this novel.
What about this exhibition at the Ransom Center? Is this for a limited time only, or is it possible that it could be exhibited in other places?
Yeah. Certainly. So I would probably say that if you are in Austin or even in the United States, you are listening to you, you should first come to the Ramson Center because there are some items that aren't going to be shown here. So this is, in many ways, is an extraordinary exhibition because Garcia Marquez is also influenced by extremely important writers of the 20th century. So we have the galley proofs of the Ulysses of James Joyce, As I Lay Dying of Faulkner, the manuscript is there, Virginia Woolf, the Kew Gardens, books by Kafka, Borges, Julio Cortázar's Rayuela manuscript, and these are works of art that we put in dialogue with Garcia Marquez precisely to show how they influence him. And some of these items would not travel to the next venue, which is going to be in the Museum of Modern Art in Mexico City in November.
Boy, that's spectacular. Congratulations on curating such an important exhibit, and the fact that we have it here in Texas is really doubly special. Yeah. Alvaro Santana Acuña curated the bilingual exhibit, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, The Making of a Global Writer, that opened this past weekend. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Ascent to Glory, The Transformation of 100 Years of Solitude into a Global Classic. The exhibit is open in Texas until July. Good to see you, sir. Thank you so much for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios.
Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU. With a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, lead on. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Classes at Texas A&M Commerce have been canceled through Wednesday after a shooting yesterday in a dorm on the southwest corner of the campus. The school had been placed on lockdown midday with a shelter-in-place order, police fearing an active shooter. Two women were killed and a two-year-old was injured and hospitalized, but the school is calling the event an isolated incident. Gun violence, however, is hardly an isolated matter. Indeed, a new poll by the Dallas Morning News and the University of Texas and Tyler has been exploring Texas attitudes about gun control policies, and Allie Morris has been covering this issue for the Dallas Morning News. Allie, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Among other issues this survey explored was the question of background checks for gun purchases. What sort of checks and what did you find?
Yeah, so the poll looked at a wide range of different types of gun policies, but the one that had the most support was expanding background checks for gun purchases. And this poll comes, you know, about 6 months after the mass shooting in El Paso killed 22 people last summer. And what we found is that background checks is something lawmakers have been a little bit reluctant to talk about here in Texas, you know, where they favored loosening restrictions on guns more than putting new ones in place.
Right.
But background checks is something that Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has been talking about. You know, he came out earlier this year saying that he might be interested in expanding those background checks to stranger-to-stranger sales, excluding friends and family. But that would be a step that, you know, Republicans haven't taken in Texas.
Yes. And so what did the survey say about those attitudes? I mean, did it show a majority of Texans in support for of expanding background checks or what?
It did. It was about 86% supported expanding background checks, and that was bipartisan. You know, support obviously was lower among Republicans, but it was a pretty overwhelming majority who supported that change. And also interesting to note is that the poll found generally across the board for all five of these policies that we asked about, enthusiasm was stronger among women for gun control policies than men.
There was also a question having to do with so-called red flag laws. These are laws that permit police to take guns away from people that a judge has ruled to be dangerous. What does the survey say about that? I mean, is there majority support for red flag laws?
Yeah, there was actually above 60% support for red flag laws as well, which was a majority. And again, what we saw across the board is that Republicans tended to, or these policies tended to lose support among Republicans the more restrictive they became. So, for example, banning the sale of assault-style weapons drew less support, as did a weapon buyback program, which is what former presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke suggested mm-hmm. during a debate earlier this year.
Right. I wonder just how surprised we should be about these numbers. I mean, do they reflect a change, or have these questions been asked over a longitudinal basis, that is to say, over a period of time?
Yeah, they have been asked over a period of time, and we've seen some like expanding background checks, you know, support for that has been high. What we saw for Beto O'Rourke's policy that he suggested, a buyback program.
Mandatory buybacks, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. We saw support for that actually falter around November, mm-hmm. which is when, you know, Republicans were getting pretty fired up, Republican leaders in the party getting fired up about the policy, really attacking it. But now the poll that we took most recently in January found that support has grown a little bit since November. And so that led political scientists to kind of theorize that when, you know, there's an attack on a specific policy, support may go down, but then after those conclude, support may rise again.
There's a lot to dig through when it comes to how the poll was conducted and that sort of thing. We're going to link to more on this survey at texasstandard.org. Allie Morris is with the Dallas Morning News. Allie, thanks so much for sharing a bit of this with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Hey, Wells Dunbar, you know who won the Iowa caucus?
Still hanging fire on that one,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Yeah. I was wondering if you knew. I mean, if anyone would know, it would be Wells Dunbar, because he's plugged into that,
have
you know,
not heard massive, yet. Still waiting on those numbers to come out. I mean, is there anything else we could be waiting on? There's the State of the Union
State
going
of the
on
Union,
tonight. Lots
something
of other
happening
stuff.
In the U.S. Senate tomorrow, I think.
Yes,
maybe.
Exactly. But for right now, we're hearing from folks about the story we just shared, that new poll showing Texan support expanded background checks for gun purchases, and to a slightly lesser extent, those red flag laws that could take guns away from potentially dangerous people. Lots of people chiming in on this one on our Facebook page. Clark Hindley says he's left with just one question. Are our legislators listening? Don't they work for us? And of course, a topic like this, David, engenders a range of opinions, mm-hmm. and we're seeing that borne out on our Facebook page as well. Kevin Gunter says, Texans are not open to red flag laws. They shall not infringe upon our constitutional rights. However, Christine Schaefer counters that this sharpshooter Texan supports red flag laws. Gun ownership requires responsible citizens. If you prove yourself irresponsible, then the consequences need to be implemented. And of course, David, we should note, as we heard in the news roundup midway through the show, two people were killed in a shooting inside a dormitory at the Texas A&M.
Yeah,
A&M
wasn't a
Commerce.
Whole lot known about that yeah. for a long time.
Strange
yeah,
situation,
several law
obviously.
Enforcement agencies are involved with that one, and yeah. being rather tight-lipped about the details.
Yeah, campus went on lockdown. Interesting comment here from an A&M alum on Facebook. Colin Onalandi, he writes that, what I loved and learned about Aggie Spirit was the idea of looking at problems differently. Well, Ags, let's fight the status quo of this crazy gun culture, what he says there. Well, you know, David, in other news, large swaths of Texas bracing for an Arctic blast tonight and an abrupt end to some of those warmer temperatures
bracing.
Experienced. Yeah.
Well, did you see that picture from Dalhart?
Well, I was going to say, it's already hit Midland, Odessa. Temperatures dropped there. I loved this tweet from the National Weather Service Midland office. They tweeted, it's all downhill from here as temperatures fall and the skies yeah. become cloudy. So already affecting many parts of the state. But yeah, I think the freezing precipitation, stuff like that. Many communities bracing for that sort of stuff yep. later tonight.
It's crazy because we were in, did we hit 80 over the weekend?
It was
we're
warm.
Awfully
I
close.
Mean, heck, it's like pretty warm out there today. I think I referred to this sort of weather as like dragon weather. It's like you bundle up the kids in the morning and then they're mm-hmm. dragging their coats when they come home from
yeah.
school.
Well, I like that, dragon weather, yeah. That ought to go into the into the glossary somewhere. But we're out of time for the big broadcast. You know where to find more news about Texas. We go over to texasstandard.org. And of course, we're going to be back here on the wireless set tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.